Welcome to this week's edition of the Hindus Parlay, which is our weekly podcast to discuss contemporary policy issues. This is Vikas Dhoot, your host for the week. We are discussing the implications of the proposed sale of the national carrier Air India and its implications specifically on the future of India's public sector and the center's plans to divest its holdings in many more such state-run enterprises in the coming months and years. While this year's budget, we saw the government unveiling a bold new disinvestment policy that envisages a bare minimum presence of government-owned businesses, even in the strategic sectors. The government is also at the same time pursuing the sale of its entire stake in public sector firms like BPCL, Shipping Corporation of India, IDBI Bank, and two other public sector banks and one general insurance company in this financial year itself, which by any reckoning, given our country's recent disinvestment record, is an ambitious target. To share their insights and perspectives with our listeners on this ongoing political economy saga, we have with us Mr. Ashok Chawla, who over his 40-year career in the civil services has steered several state-run enterprises, including, driving the implementation of the ambitious Sardar Sarovar Narmada project. He's also served as a secretary to the Government of India in very, very critical portfolios, including civil aviation, finance, and economic affairs. Mr. Chawla, who retired recently as the Competition Commission of India chairperson, has had a unique insider view on developments around Air India in the past two decades that we hope to glean from more. Accompanying him is Arvind Mehta, an alumnus of the Delhi School of Economics, who was the secretary to the 15th Finance Commission. The Finance Commission, as we know, advises on the sharing of resources between the center and states and plays a very, very critical role in India's federal framework. During his career in the IAS, Mr. Mehta has worked extensively in very, very important ministries such as the Defense Ministry, Finance, as well as Commerce. He's handled sensitive issues, including the South Asian Trade Desk, the negotiations pertaining to the World Trade Organization, and other critical trade pacts that India has been pursuing over the last decade. Working now as a senior fellow in the Niti Aayog, Mr. Mehta is advising on policy issues that affect state governments. He's also served, most importantly for us, in the Department of Disinvestment in two separate stints in 2005-06. And earlier in 2001, the early days of frenetic activity in disinvestment under the Atal Bihari Vajpayee regime. This was when the Air India sale was first being pursued. Let me begin by welcoming both of you to the Parle. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Chawla and Mr. Mehta.
Thank you.
And before we go into the present and, a bit into the future, I thought, given your vast experience, I thought if I could request both of you to first give us your understanding of how things came to such a pass at Air India over the years in terms of losses and operational problems. And what do you think stalled previous attempts to reform or even sell the airline? Mr. Chawla, if I may request you to start.
Because I think it's in the public domain that Air India 2-3 decades ago was one of the premier airlines of the world. It slowly, steadily, but definitely went into a spin. And while an attempt, as you mentioned, was made in the early 2000s to see if it could be disinvested based on the recommendations of the then Disinvestment Commission, that didn't move very far. And then the experts advised and the Ministry of Civil Aviation somehow took the view that it would be good if the two airlines, that is Air India and Indian Airlines, were merged and we would have a strong kind of presence in the aviation sector. So the merger took place in 2007. There was a lot of positivity and euphoria about it at that point in time. Slowly, it came to pass that mergers are easy to handle on paper. But unless one can really bring the two organizations culturally together, unless one can reap the benefits of synergy in terms of cost saving, in terms of employees reduction and so on and so forth, it actually might lead to a bigger problem. And that's what happened. in the sense that the synergies didn't happen, but the two airlines, the total financial bill kept getting bloated. And it soon reached a stage where the model also, the Air India, Indian Airlines model, full service airline, etc., while perfectly valid for the international sector, started getting difficult to handle in terms of operational efficiency and economy in the domestic sector. And then the low-cost airlines came in. And while India is a big market so far as aviation is concerned, and it will continue to be for some time, it's also a very price-sensitive market. The net result was that the low-cost carriers overtook Air India in the merged entity, went into a tailspin from which it never came out. And if what is now in the public domain, we are told that every day it was losing 20 crores. That was the ultimate nadir which the airline had reached. And I think it's only appropriate that the government has pushed the company to a final disinvestment. It's certainly long overdue. But even then, it's been a momentous decision which will serve the aviation space in India well, and of course the government and the public sector as a whole.
Mr. Mehta, would you also share with us some of your experiences in those days of 2001 when Air India was still a disinvestment candidate, and what transpired in that period?
Yes, Vikas. Mr. Ashok Chawla, of course, has summarized it very well. But just to give you a little bit more insider view, I was part of the transaction team that was looking at this particular divestment transaction for Air India and Indian Airlines in 2001. And there were many factors that kept playing. There was strong buyer interest. There was, in fact, also interest from a corporate house which did not have aviation experience. And there were all kinds of muddying of the waters going on also by some of the private airlines that feared competition if this divestment transaction did go through. So to cut a long story short, what really happened was that in the ensuing confusion that happened at that point of time of lobbying of various kinds, there was also an advice that was given that enterprise value of the airlines would increase if there is a merger, and then they can use a hub and spoke model for their synergizing their operations, and it will mean that when the divestment takes place later, then you will get a better enterprise value for a merged entity. So in some ways the government did agree to this kind of advice, put the immediate divestment on a back burner, and went ahead, as Mr. Ashok Chawla has already summarized, with the merger proposal, which finally happened much later. But the underlying weakness that really happened with that merger was that, as he said, there were two very different cultures. There was also a difference in the employee strength per aircraft. And the merger did not go through in the manner that was envisaged to increase the divestment value, but in fact led to a greater deal of losses because also of the large purchases and the debt servicing, etc., that started building up. Personally, I'm very glad that finally the government has bitten the bullet, so to say, and has managed to do a transaction which was long overdue. I'll stop there.
In fact, I mean, if you recall, in his first year in office, Prime Minister Narendra Modi had announced that the government had no business to be in business. Yet over the last 7 years, we couldn't see any significant PSU sales materializing. In fact, earlier attempt to sell Air India in this government also did not sort of fructify. And a few public sector firms were sold to other public sector firms instead. But with this, like Mr. Mehta said, with the government now biting the bullet on Air India, and announcing the airline sale to the Tata Group, its original promoters, would you say this breaks the taboo in some ways about the taboos associated with disinvestment in our political economy in recent years? Essentially, this is the first sale, if it goes through, in 18 years. So, Mr. Chawla and Mr. Mehta, both of you can.
Yeah, because it's certainly a long-awaited positive signal of the government policy on the public sector. Because as you mentioned, what has happened in the last 18, 20 years, whichever government has been in power, there's been share sale, shareholding sale from one pocket to the other, etc., but no real, no genuine privatization. So this is the first such thing. And in that sense, it sends out a very positive signal, both for the public sector entities, more so for the investors, domestic as well as foreign. So the logical inference, therefore, one can draw is that this is going to be now the way the government is approaching some of these public sector entities and the issue of disinvestment, in which, you, as you mentioned, has also been articulated by the finance minister in the budget speech. So there is euphoria, there is expectation, but as one can appreciate in all such matters, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. So I would say that the euphoria needs to be tempered a bit for a number of reasons. One, of course, the broad policy is there, but you know, when you get into the details of the architecture, strategic sectors, each sector will have 2-3 enterprises, will continue to be with the government and so on. So one doesn't know at the end of the day whether there will really be a fairly robust pipeline of public sector entities which are up for offer. It should not be that there is an asymmetry between what government offers and what the investors are really interested in. Number two, there is the parallel track which the government is pursuing for fiscal mathematics, which is the monetization track. So if you push the disinvestment track aggressively, the monetization track is already sort of being pushed very aggressively from what one hears and reads, then the issue will arise, is there adequate appetite and capacity on the other side of the table to pick up all these kinds of proposals which are being put on the table by the government. Thirdly, we have to appreciate, and past experience bears that out, that the process of disinvestment is long drawn, complicated. It has been so even in the first round 20 years ago. It used to take quite a while. That has not much has changed in that regard. And finally, I think there is the elephant in the room, which one cannot ignore, which is what is the window of opportunity with the parliament elections coming up in 2024, which is 2.5 years away. So at best, the window of opportunity for either this kind of disinvestment or for the monetization, though we are not really discussing that today, but is the twin track which the government is pursuing. The window of opportunity is at best about 18 months, 20 months. So whatever government can do in that, and let's hope they are able to do a fair amount to fulfill their broad objective of actually pulling back from business where they do not need to be in business. That will really be a welcome step for the stakeholders, for the economy, and for the people at large.
Right. You actually ended up answering some of the other questions I had in mind already. But Mr. Mehta, what do you think this sort of, would you agree this sort of gives a more enthusiastic situation for investors to participate in future stake sales? And what could be the challenges in terms of, if the NDA between 1999 and 2003 could privatize 17 firms, can we look at a similar streak in the window that we have before the next Lok Sabha polls, as Sir said?
Yes, so if we were to go back a little bit again into the history of the privatization that started in the Vajpayee era, the commitment was very strong to the divestment being of the privatization nature through strategic sales. That was the commitment. And you did see Modern Foods being the first case, even though it was a loss-making unit, it was well absorbed. And then you had Balco. And slowly you started seeing many more, like IPCL. You had the share sales of Maruti transaction, which happened, which gave controlling interest away. So there was a momentum that was building up along what one can call actual privatization, that momentum was building up. But when the government finally came to the BPCL sale, that's when the pushback started happening and many in the parliament started questioning that why should you divest a very profit-making CPSU, whereas you could possibly have a reason for doing it for loss-making PSUs, but why do it for a profit-making PSUs? And with that kind of pushback that happened, there was a loss of the momentum that did take place. And then, of course, with the change in the government that happened, the entire philosophy, in fact, of divestment was entirely different. Because we must remember it was a coalition supported by the left, and ideologically there was no support there at all for any privatization. So what happened was it became stake sales, saying that we will sell part shares but not below 51%. That became the broad creed. And they had set up a Bureau of Public Sector Enterprises that would sort of examine the cases regarding the loss-making CPSUs and then make a recommendation. But that was more a mechanism by which no real recommendation came out, and the loss-making CPSUs also continued thereafter. So in a sense, for a long time of the time period, there was this complete turnaround that happened. And in fact, I do remember when I came back to the disinvestment ministry in 2005-2006, I could see that the milieu had changed completely. There was no appetite for strategic sales, specifically of the kind that were being done earlier. And there were part sales that were taking place of tranche. I think the real value that I see in this Air India sale now is that, again, there has been a clarity of a thought that wherever the government feels that whether it's a loss-making or a profit-making CPSU, but the government wants to make a strategic exit, they are willing to do that. And I'm particularly happy that the present DPAM has found a mechanism for a strategic sale of a loss-making unit like Air India, because it's easy to sell something like BPCL. It'll attract buyers based upon the enterprise value and the profits. But it's not easy to attract buyers when there are huge losses on the books of the enterprise. And they have found a via media by way of bringing in certain sweeteners into the deal, which has attracted investor interest to the extent that a sale can go through. I think it's a good learning experience for them. And I hope that many of the other loss-making units that are continuously bleeding the taxpayer, those loss-making units also, the DPAM is able to innovatively find the right sweeteners to get strategic buyers. I do certainly look forward to those transactions.
So that's an interesting point, actually, that Air India, like you mentioned, is a loss-making enterprise. So the fact is selling it is saving the taxpayer money immediately. While, as you said, in the past, we stand at a similar juncture again when we're trying to sell BPCL because it's a highly profitable PSU. And, you know, we have heard the usual criticism from the trade unions and left parties on Air India's sale. But do you fear that, you know, coming to profitable PSUs and hiving them off will again attract a wider groundswell of opposition and criticism?
Well, I do see that possibility that as and when profitable PSUs are sold, the public perception ideological battle will be stronger, saying what is the need to sell something which is giving you good dividends, you're selling the family silver, etc., etc. It's far more difficult to justify those kinds of sales, as it would be easier to justify the loss-making sales, but the loss-making sales are actually far more difficult and the challenge is much, much greater because each transaction has its own set of complexities given the kind of valuations that you have to do. And you have to really be able to communicate with the markets quite well to be able to structure a particular mechanism. As you see in Air India also, they had earlier structured a 76% stake sale with a 74% with a 26% share sale with the government, but it obviously did not find favor in the market, and that's why the transaction couldn't go through. So in the next iterative round, they were able to structure a 100% sale. So these kinds of market perceptions will have to be dealt with. The battle public perception wise will be easier for the loss making units, and in some ways it's more vital to get out of those immediately because they do bleed the taxpayer. There is a lot of budgetary support that eventually goes into such enterprises. So it's, in my view, it's actually critical to do, try and do those ones as quickly as possible. The more profitable ones will have a different kind of a challenge, but the sale actually will be easier in those cases. I stop there.
Mr. Chawla, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with Arvind in the sense that there will be the usual noises when profit-making enterprises are sold. But if the government clearly articulates its policy, which they have been trying to do on what they want to sell and what they want to retain. And I think generally, the while people may object for the sake of objecting, but the general, I would say that the general consensus across the political spectrum at least is that, you know, public sector is no longer and need not be occupy the commanding heights of the economy. Those have already moved to the private sector. So the public sector in many of these areas is actually just bringing up the rear. So there's not much point. And as long as the process is run in a very transparent manner, I think there will not be too much objection. And it could also be, I mean, the government might also want to sort of consider setting up some kind of expert body in the nature of a disinvestment commission, as was there at that point in time, which will then be used, can be used to convey to the community and the political spectrum that here is an expert body which has made these recommendations. We are sort of accepting those, and we are on the right path, which is broadly in conformity with whatever we have announced so far.
I just wanted to add one more perspective to this entire way this is shaping out. I remember during the Vajpayee era, we'd had an internal discussion in the Department of Disinvestment. In the internal discussion, we had pointed out that there was very good value that could be got for the government by doing some of the financial sector share sales in the banks, etc. And I do remember it's that the then minister, Mr. Arun Shori, then had clearly said that, look, let's not open up too many fronts. The financial sector will open up a huge battle again. Let's choose our battles and not push ahead on that sector at this stage. Whereas in this government, I think in the Modi era now, they haven't been shy of saying that they will do some amount of strategic sales, if necessary, even for some of the banks which they will choose. So that's in fact an even more of a shift that I see between the Vajpayee era and the Modi era, that they are now quite willing to look at the financial sector for divestment. And I think partly it has also helped because public sector banks are no longer being viewed as the only banking mechanism. You've got private sector banks which have now grown large enough that the role of the public sector banks is somewhat diminished, and some of them can be strategically chosen for outright divestments also.
Yeah, that's actually a big shift in terms of the boldness of the disinvestment approach now. At least that is being attempted, and we hope some of it fructifies. In fact, if we, again, since given our history of disinvestment has been so short that we have to keep going back to the NDA era of 1999 to 2003, where, like you said, Modern Foods was a loss-making PSU which kicked off the process. But and some of the other PSUs like Balco and all were also on the verge of or already had turned sick. And most of them turned around quite well in private hands later. But we also saw some profitable PSUs like CMC Limited and VSNL are being sold out at that time. So perhaps there is, like you and Mr. Chawla say, there is still possibility that we can manage the narrative on BPCL and other profitable PSU sales if we can garner opinion around and galvanize opinion on the reasons and rationale for it to manage perceptions.
Yes. So, ultimately, this is the political process. I think once the political resolve is there, I'm sure the transaction teams will find it much easier to move through the transactions. So ultimately, yes, it is the political resolve that will matter.
On a related note, I mean, given those 17 cases that were privatized, there was a very interesting study done by this Kelly School of Business professor Nandini Gupta, along with a peer from Sloan School of Management. And they found that, you know, in the 17-odd PSUs that were sold then, not a single PSU was privatized where the cabinet minister in charge of the PSU had the PSU was having the operation in the same state as the cabinet minister. So, you know, of course, these are political compulsions that tend to come up. And do you expect such tendencies to crop up? Because we have a permanent electoral cycle in state of polls, state elections, general elections, panchayat elections, you know. So such considerations do you expect, if not from the point of view of ministers in charge, but maybe, you know, state-wise considerations that, you know, you defer a particular sale after the election in that state? Or Mr. Chabla?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's been the history of all these major economic moves to some extent. But I think this is also now, you know, 2021 is very different from what it was 10 years, 20 years, 30 years ago. So, I guess it's not much of a problem now, because as Arvind said, that if the political resolve is strong, then I don't think these things are going to matter very much. But since you've asked me to come in here, let me say that the whole process will get further energized, because at the moment, what apart from the politics of it, you know, the whole thing is being perceived as something which the government wants to do because they don't have money. So it's more like, you know, they're pressed to the wall. So they're trying to push privatization or monetization on the other hand, because paisa nahi hai. And they need money for, you know, their welfare programs and running the government and so on and so forth. And the, you know, the structurally also the DIPAM is part of the finance ministry, which unlike the NDA where it was a separate ministry, after that, it's been tagged along with the finance ministry, which again sends out the signal that basically, you know, it's a balancing the books kind of exercise. So I think if the government is serious, as it seems to be, there should be a separate ministry or a commission which reports directly to the Prime Minister's office. That will make things far simpler in terms of the mechanics of implementing the program of disinvestment. And minor political issues of, you know, particular minister being happy or unhappy or not, etc., etc., those things will not really come to the surface. But that's again a political call which the executive has to take on how they want to push this.
Mr. Mehta, you've seen some of this.
Yeah. If I may just add a little bit of my perspective that I have seen, you are right. It was actually... For a strategic sale, it used to always be difficult to convince the concerned ministry, which was dealing and owned in the sense that CPSU, to come fully on board, because for them it was a sense of loss that they would be losing something. So there would always be various reasons that would be given of why it's not the appropriate time, etc. They had no problem with part sale shares as long as ownership control did not go out of the ministry's hands. So that kind of a problem always remained. And that's why I said strategic sales are far more difficult than part sales of shares. I think the mood has changed now. I think it's pretty clear that the Prime Minister has said that the government has no business to be in business. He has made it clear that he doesn't want to see IAS officers and others being the ones who are running CPSUs without fully commercially involved in those operations and being changed from time to time. So there is a clear resolve that is being publicly articulated. So I think that kind of a mindset that there was earlier, where a ministry could try and sabotage some kind of a strategic sale, I don't think we are going to see that kind of resistance in this time period. But what worries me actually is The narrative that goes out that the government is doing these sales because it needs to cover its fiscal deficit and, you know, it's doing it only for that. I think that narrative is very damaging because it's then in the public perception, it is simply a sale of, you know, the family silver and it's the family silver being sold because. So I would be happier with a narrative that does not talk about the monetary aspect so much as the need for, you know, fixing the fiscal deficit gap, etc. Because I think that does more damage to the public supports rather than simply saying that we are convinced that society is better off by having this not being a government-run entity, but a private sector-run entity. Society is better off. And I think if that narrative is stronger, it would be better because if you really look at it, beyond a point, the disinvestment proceeds have never been of that substantive a value compared to the overall government receipts that they would be something which is very, very critical for the government. If it lets its fiscal deficit, say, slip by about 1% in a year, that's about 2 lakh crore. And that's what the disinvestment target as a whole for a year would be. So whether the fiscal deficit shifts by 0.5 or 0.7, it doesn't really matter so much as saying that, oh, we have to sell because we need that money. I think that narrative actually needs to stop. And it will make the job easier for convincing the public.
Yeah, he's right. Arvind is absolutely right. I think the focus should now be totally on efficiency, productivity increases, and not on, balancing the books.
So one reason historically also for the slow progress on disinvestment has been, you know, post-transaction implications. We've seen the CAG and the CBI and so on venturing into cases like the Centaur Hotels sale, for instance, where a corruption case was invoked on the disinvestment, earlier disinvestment minister and the secretary. And of course, the former finance minister, P. Chidambaram, when the UPA was in power, ensured that these cases were closed and, you know, no such witch hunt went on in that particular matter. But do you think, I mean, this is the Prevention of Corruption Act amendments. I think our late former finance minister Arun Jaitley also talked about it, that it's important to protect officials for their bona fide actions taken in good faith. But those amendments were talked about in the initial part of this government, but we have not yet seen much movement. So would some of these things, you know, help galvanize faster decision making, especially not just with disinvestment, but as you mentioned, monetization is also a huge risk prone process. Would that help according to both of you?
See, because to some extent, you know, there will always be this, you know, your hindsight will be perfect 6x6, which will not be there when you are actually doing it. So some issues will be raised, but on the amendment, as far as I know, that amendment has been carried out, and the amendment to the Prevention of Corruption Act now removes a particular subsection or clause which said that even if you have not benefited monetarily, but by your action some other private party has benefited, then also you are liable for criminal action under the Prevention of Corruption Act. That was amended, I think, if I remember right, about 3 years ago. So to that extent, there is some protection, but in these things, one can never sort of expect, or one can never hope for complete immunity from the kind of oversight which comes post facto, because you do things, people do things by and large in good faith, and then when you look, somebody looks at them differently after a gap of a few years, and why did you sell at this price and why not at that price, and so on and so forth. So the only solution is to keep the process as transparent as possible, to make sure that the whole sort of loop in terms of the process is followed in letter and spirit. And on that particular aspect, which was causing a lot of problem, that has since been removed. So cases which arise after that date are now not going to be taken up. Only if there are acts prior to that, and we are not talking of those kind of cases here, but those things will continue, because in criminal law, if there was a particular law at that point in time prior to say July 2018, then those would still be covered under the old Prevention of Corruption Act provisions.
Smita, I mean, Air India's case, for instance, the losing bidder has been quite gracious about the bid being awarded to the Tata's group. But, you know, in more profitable PSUs, we could see, losing bidders also raising allegations and other concerns or, trying to stall the process. So, what do you think can be done to avoid some of that kind of friction and help faster decisions?
So, I agree 100% with Mr. Ashok Chawla when he says that, hindsight can always give you 20/20 vision. And anybody with hindsight can say, oh, why didn't you think of this or why didn't you think of that? This could have made it better. It's like the armchair criticism of MS Dhoni. If he's attempted a sixer and then somebody says that he should have attempted a sixer and somebody will say he should not have thrown his wicket away. It's very easy to do a little bit of armchair analysis at the end. And I do remember in the Vajpayee era, we had actually proposed that for greater transparency, of course, the procedures were very tight even then. It went through several layers of validation of the Committee of Secretaries and the empowered group of ministers, etc., and then the cabinet decision. So there was a multi-layered mechanism of checks and balances that were built in. But in addition to that, we had actually suggested a concurrent audit to be done by a CAG officer along with the transaction so that if there was any whistleblowing to be done from the auditor's perspective, it could be done immediately while the transaction was going on. And I do remember that I was told that, typically the CAG does not like to do a concurrent audit. They like to come and do an audit ex post facto of the transaction. So I personally am still in favor. I'm still in favor of a concurrent auditor also being a part of the transaction team from an independent agency outside the ministry. In my view, that adds a greater credence and transparency to the process. But I'm not so sure whether the CNAG office would be willing to bring in that kind of a risk for their own officer, because then he would be as much a party to the criticism of a 20/20 hindsight. So, yes, it's difficult. It's difficult. And in the case of Air India, for instance, it's very easy later on to pick up some kind of angle and say that, oh, this could have been done better for a better valuation. In fact, I think the officers concerned have been very bold to have taken the decision that they have taken to get the best valuation. And fortunately, now the kind of opposition that there used to be earlier, say, to the ITDC, hotel sales, etc., is more muted. I think the general public also now does accept the fact that some of these CPSUs the government needs to let go of. So hopefully no particular witch hunts will be started by any government on these accounts.
Yeah, we'll keep our fingers crossed for that. And just want to also get a sense of, do you think there should be some no-go sectors, like, for instance, a resource-dependent sector like coal, for instance? Should we, of course, the government has said we'll retain bare minimum presence in strategic sectors, but should there be reason for people to be worried? For instance, in airports and ports, we are already seeing, one or two groups getting a lot of assets under their control and then sort of... In the Adani port case, for instance, they've banned shipments from Iran, and this is sort of taking a unilateral private sector action, which determines often extraneous outcomes. So, in that sense, do you think there are some sectors which you should consider holy cows even today, maybe coal and other energy dependent sectors, to be retained in the public sector?
I think the finance minister has already listed out some broad things. The sectors, defense, atomic energy, oil and gas, and probably coal is there. So there will be some public sector enterprises which will continue in those areas. Of course, those sectors are also open for, most of those sectors are open for private sector participation as it is. But I'm sure government will keep that in mind, because public policy would demand, would certainly require that some areas there is government presence And they're planning to do it not just in these areas, but also in the, as you mentioned yourself, in the financial sector, the insurance sector, and so on and so forth. So it's likely to be a calibrated exercise with some things kept reserved. My only fear is that the reserved list should not be so large and so big, which defeats this whole purpose. Because some of the better PSUs, I mean the PSUs which can be privatized more easily, will also be in some of these areas. So we'll have to see how the balance is struck.
Mr. Mehta, you want to weigh in on this?
If I just add into that, there's a famous comment of the previous finance minister, Mr. Arun Jaitley, regarding the Air India sale, where he had said that if you wait too long, there will be no airline left to sell. So I think the government does need to keep an eye on any particular CPSU which is bleeding so badly that its valuations can get destroyed beyond a point where you then have to go for liquidation. And I hope that situation, if it's arising, the government is able to move quickly on those transactions first. If there was a kind of a prioritization, I would prioritize those kinds of bleeding enterprises. For instance, Scooters India has been bleeding for so long. I'm not so sure whether anybody would be interested except for a slump sale, which is to do for the assets, but not as a running enterprise. So I'm not so sure they will be able to get buyers given the kind of liabilities they've accumulated. But if you ask me, yes, there is a role for certain kind of countervailing mechanisms, as Mr. Ashok Chawla said, in a calibrated fashion. We don't do any fire sales. I don't think that's advisable at all. There has to be calibration. There has to be also a watch on the market appetite. We don't want those kinds of sales which happened in certain countries where oligarchs came and just lapped up all the public sector assets and then became billionaires at the cost of the social good. So there has to be calibration. And then there are certain CPSUs which are the kind where, for instance, if you look at the ones to do with hydropower production, NHPC, SJVNL, Terry Hydro, NEEPCO, these are the ones which are strategic from the point of view that private sector, from our experience that we have been working in this sector, private sector has not really been able to get the kind of risk appetite of the long gestation lags and the geological risks that happen in these kinds of projects. So while you can do brownfield asset monetization, that's not a problem. But for greenfield development in these kinds of areas, I don't think there is any substitute for the sovereign taking that risk. And therefore, you do need them because you do need to get balancing power through hydro, given the fact that solar is moving, you need balancing power for balancing it out by other commodities and coal. So there will always be a rationale, and I don't think we need to go for any fire sale.
Okay. So just down to my last couple of questions, wanted to get a sense from you on how can states be sort of nudged to take up similar disinvestment in their own set of state PSUs? Mr. Chawla, you've run some of the PSUs in Gujarat as well in your time. Within state governments, how can this be sort of incentivized by the center? They've proposed some incentives, but how do we get some momentum behind that?
My own sense is that there's not much which the states can really gain by selling some of the enterprises, because most of them, the steam has gone out of them over a period of time. By and large, they are loss making, or they have been subjected to so much competition that unless they were operating in some kind of reserved activity, there is not much there. So I guess once this this whole process takes on a dynamism of its own and people realize the benefits of pulling back and government not spending money, whether it's the state government or the center, these things will happen over a period of time. For instance, in Gujarat, my impression is that apart from a few joint ventures which are doing well, where there is participation by other companies or by the stock market, then their performance is is reasonably good, but that's not really, you know, there's not as if they're not really entirely the of the ownership of the government. In most other enterprises, there's not much value left. And I think that's the situation perhaps in most of the state governments, where the most of the states where the old corporations or the old public sector, state public sector enterprises continue to exist. They're not really fading away because we don't allow anything to die so easily, but they will go that route sooner than later.
Mr. Mehta, you're also advising states, you're advising the Niti Aayog on how to help states take certain policy actions. I mean, how do you weigh in on this? And also, given that this this problem of PSUs, which have virtually shut operations and are, you know, perennially sick, whether it's in the center and states, what is the best way to dispose of such, you know, PSUs where there is no value beyond maybe just the scrap and land parcels?
So I agree with Mr. Chaglav that, you know, by a natural process, we have seen many of the state PSUs dying out, and the states have quietly allowed through attrition and voluntary retirements to keep it going in a manner where they know that they are going to die out eventually. It's happened to quite a few. But there are some which are very much actively supported by the state governments also. Specifically, if they've used them as SPVs to raise funds for some of their infrastructure activities, etc., I don't think they will let those kinds of financing arm CPSUs die out so easily, because they serve a useful purpose for some of the states, which utilize off-budget borrowings for some of the infrastructure funding that they wish to raise. As a general process, certainly in one sector, which is the tourism sector, I think there has been enough experience. If you look at the case, say, of Haryana, in the mid-80s, Haryana had a flourishing CPSU, which was the talk of the country in terms of its having developed very nice tourist spots, etc. But institutionally, the governments have not been able to really manage them as profitable enterprises. They start crumbling away slowly. So possibly if the state governments can even as a first shot start giving up their hold on their hotels, etc., I think that would be a good start, because there will be enough appetite. They have some of the best tourist locations, and there's a lot of value which can be built up in society by letting it go into private hands. So these kinds of measures will help. And you're right, some of them simply are sitting now on land which can be monetized and used. So there will have to be some kind of an active role being played by that land monetization policy also.
I think we've covered a lot of ground, and I know given the expertise and insights that both of you have, I'm sure we could possibly talk for another hour if we wanted to and I had the permission from you. But I think we must acknowledge that the fact is that the government has taken a bold decision, which has sort of been keeping its own finances on tenterhooks every year, not knowing what will be the Air India bill for bailing out every year. And so I'm really grateful to the both of you for sharing your insights and perspectives with our readers. And I hope that at the end of the conversation, they get a sense and a better idea of the rationale and the reasons why the Indian economy needs disinvestment to go forward a little more aggressively. Like Mr. Chawla has said, efficiency and productivity gains should be the driving force, not just revenue and deficit management. And given that we've managed to start with a loss-making PSU, which was like the epitome of public sector dysfunctionality in recent years for India, it's augurs well that, you know, more such sales, including like Mr. Mehta mentioned, of more such sales are prioritized of loss-making PSUs, and there is greater public support for profitable PSUs as well to be sold going forward. On that note, I would like to take your leave, and again, thank you so much for sparing time with us, and I hope to host you again in a future edition of the Parley soon. Thank you, Mr. Chawla, and thank you so much, Mr. Mehta.
Thank you, Vikas. Thank you, Arvind.
Thank you, sir. And it's been a pleasure having this discussion of the ideas that have taken place. Thank you.